Welcome to Polycast, the official podcast of a Poulton Civilization site.
Van Quick,
Moses Snyder,
Imran Siddiqui,
and Makula.
With our guest co-host, Mathos from CFC. Since Mathos is the guest co-host and he's listened to every episode of the show, he's raring and roaring to go with the introductions.
Every episode?
Wow, you listen to more episodes than I do.
We have Daniel Quick, can't stop talking. We have Imru, Wilder, and who is spinning with us for a while.
Oh, cheater.
Makalua, is that right?
There you go. Yes.
We just call her Maki.
Call her girl playing Civ.
No. I mean, I am, but no.
So why is it Wooter and Locutus? Why you got both names?
Hmm? Locutus is his forum name.
Well, is Mathos your real name?
Yeah.
My parents named me Mathos.
For some reason, I kept thinking you've used the Wooter before as a forum name. I guess not.
No.
I never did.
You haven't been listening to the show as closely as you claim. Do you have any suggestions for things to be changed, things you'd like to see stay, things you would like to see gone?
Don't put them on the spot or anything.
Yeah.
Maybe. I enjoy them. You randomize a lot. Different people come in and out different times. A lot of joking around. But I remember at first I was kind of confused because I thought this isn't very professional, but then I realized you're not trying to be.
Yeah.
At least I hope not. If you are, I'm sorry.
No. Then he stopped and said, "Oh, these are from Paul." Oh, I get it now.
Speaking of that, I tried to explain to my wife the difference between Politan and CFC, and of course, you know, she just rolls her eyes and says, "Dorks."
Oh.
Hey, that's farther than Ladder has gone. I don't think his family still knows he's involved in this sordid affair.
No, not really.
I'm not for sure what the difference is between dork, nerd, geek, and all that, but she makes sure that she tells me, "No, you're a dork." You don't say I'm a geek, she goes, "No, you're a dork." I don't know what the difference is.
I think the geeks are more of the pimply, pocket-protected type of sort.
Yeah, I thought that was the nerd, whereas the geek was a someone in tune with technology, but someone that might actually, at some point in the future, have a social life.
I thought that was the nerds.
No, I don't think so. I think nerds are into them, but, you know, the geeks are the ones that are socially inept.
And I think, Mathos, that dorks are neither going to have a social life or ever be in tune with technology, so I think you got burned there.
Oh.
It's my wife. I'm used to it. So I'm curious, has anyone ever been able to play Civ while they were doing this?
I think it would hog a little too many resources.
Just curious.
I don't play Civ normally. Why would I do it while I'm doing this?
In the new Civilization Revolution interviews with Sid Meier or Tim McCracken, Galactic Civilizations 2 Twilight of the Arnar interview with Brad Wardell, and in the mailbag, Defining Civ, Mods with Stories, and other contenders. Over in the Modcast, Events Leaving a Bad Taste, AI Cultural Victories Are Evil, and Airships, Why Are They Even in the Game? The Research Lab presents 9 suggestions for Civilization Series editions, while the Senate has Where Do You Like to Start and Why, and Loving Privateers. We then conclude with a 3-part vault. First, more power from episode 15 with Wouter, Mackie, and Kenneth Impaler WRG Ferlin, Modcast, How Civ 4 with Dual Core, May 12, 2007. With the next Galciv 2 expansion up and coming, how was the first expansion received? From episode 11 with Dan, Mackie, and Blake Walsh, News, Galactic Civilizations 2 Dark Avatar, Favorable Reviews, March 17, 2007. And speaking earlier of Civ series editions, from episode 4 with Dan and Imran, Research Lab, Highways and Maglevs, November 25th, 2006.
The news?
News.
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 Let's talk about Civilization Revolution interviews with Sid Meier and Tim McCracken. In the first one, was it CVG?
Mm-hmm.
Sid Meier was interviewed. He makes it clear that a completely redesigned for the consoles and not a port of the PC civs or whatnot, which has caused some consternation. I guess, if anything, this will be ported to the PC at some point if it's going to. But it seems clear from in our interviews and from these interviews that this is going to be geared for consoles, no matter how much people whine and moan on our forums.
Yes, because if it was ported to the PC, then they would have to whine even more.
That's true. And they've discussed new artifacts. We just knew about the Ark of the Covenant, but apparently there's the City of Atlantis and the Knights Templar as well.
Ooh.
Yes, we also knew about the Seven Cities of Gold. Shiny.
Shiny. The CVG one also goes into how has Sid's approach to Civ changed since the first game. The interesting thing is he kind of talks about Civ 1, 2, 3, 4 were evolutionary games, while Revolution is, well, somewhat revolutionary. And he says we're kind of back to Civ 1, or we're introducing the idea.
Talks about with Revolution, Sid says, we're going back to Civ 1, introducing the idea, making it as accessible and as attractive as we can. He also talks about the influences for the original core ideas and formulas of Civ, SimCity, Risk, and Empire, which I have not played before, that had exploring the world. From this first interview, when asked about PC versus console, or PC and console development going into the future, he says, we're seeing the possibility for some crossover and some game ideas that could be both PC and console. For Civilization, quote, right now we have a separate approach for console versus PC because the PC's version's really a fourth generation. It's really evolved to be a game that serves the hardcore, fanatic Civilization base, unquote. Now, I agree that Civ on the PC through Civ 4 serves the hardcore, fanatic base of the series, like us. Really? But it can also hold, and I think it does, serve well those in the middle, those who are neither new to the series or really hardcore into the series, but it also can appeal to new players through detailed in-game help and difficulty level variations. But as Barry said in the last episode, it's not that Civ Rev is simplified, it's that it's streamlined. And I think difficulties getting into the game, it's kind of like once you know the mechanics, ease of use or ease of getting into it, I think Civ Rev will appear less daunting at start, which will probably incline more people to actually pick it up and give it a try.
That could be true. The second interview that we have, the Herald Sun, Sid makes clear that basically it's designed to be kind of a few hours type of game, as opposed to the PC versions, which we know can take a long time, and therefore it's very easy to get into, play a game, even win a game in an evening or something like that, or lose one, depending, and just move on and whatnot. It says, Game Civ Revolution, we finish in a couple of hours or less.
It doesn't seem very fun, only a couple hours. That's the whole part of Civ, is sitting down and playing the game over several days, or I guess to each their own, but...
Mm. Well, the other thing that's interesting about the Herald Sun interview is Sid says this is the first Civ game that he's extremely hands-on since Civ 1. He talks about he's doing most of the nitty-gritty with this one. So, I mean, if anyone can pull it off, and imagine Sid can do so. He has surprised us before.
Yeah, and he's been working on the prototype for Civ Rev since 2005. We knew he had designed the prototype, but I don't think we had a year. He says that when I made Civ 1, we had to leave much of the game experience up to your imagination. Now we can bring the world to life right before your eyes. Through special effects, intense action, packed combat, the luscious terrain, and the sensational leaders, well, I might say luscious leaders in some cases.
Calm down. Calm down.
Sid says, I think you'll find this the best-looking and most fun game of Civ ever. Ooh, no pressure putting on yourself there, Sid.
Well, since he is doing the design programming, or leading it for the first time since Civ 1, he's got to be like, all right, kids, you've done a good job with the evolution, but watch how the master does it.
Watch the master and learn.
And then they all sit by his knee and go, ooh.
And they start singing, kumbaya.
No singing.
At one point, the interviewer says that the gameplay hasn't really changed throughout the series.
Yeah.
Huh?
Well, the basic idea of...
Well, the core gameplay.
It's changed a lot to me.
Well, I think Mackie's right. The basic idea.
Build cities, research technology, take over world, or go to space. That's... We've pretty much been doing the same thing, just shinier with more little, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's still a turn-based 4X game. The underlying concept is the same. I mean, you've added more complexity on top of the original, but it's still similar. Someone can play Civ 1 and Civ 4 and see where it's very similar.
No disagreement there that there are some similarities, but the fact that we have different victory conditions alone, for example, in Civ 1, if you didn't essentially kick ass, at some point you would lose. But now we have different victory conditions, and we've introduced not just more complexity, but there has been streamlining along the way. For example, we don't have pollution and the corruption models anymore.
I'm glad that's gone. I hated that part in Civ 3.
Ring cities.
Really? You hated it? Gee, you must be the only one.
And I think the gameplay has also improved because the AI has improved. I mean, I remember from Civ 1, you plant down a city, then the AI just loves to plant a city right next to yours, right beside yours.
Just to piss you off.
And then you start thinking, let's see, they built a city directly south of me, so if I build a city directly south of them, then I can make the letter I. Oh, I wonder how many letters I can make on the map. Ooh, fun.
That was just you.
Yeah.
Nobody else did that?
The only thing I remember about Civ 1 was the cities were like square boxes with numbers in them.
I'm building railroads across the ocean.
Ooh, yes.
I was thinking that. Oh, in the newspaper. Ooh, newspaper.
Huh? Oh, I didn't play Civ 1.
What?
For shame. And, of course, Butter, the interviewer in this Sun article, also asks if Civ Rev is turn-based, so...
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's magically become an RTS. I do love what this interviewer said at the beginning. He's like, first off, Sid, may I say thanks for wasting so much of my time playing various versions of Civilization, Railroad Tycoon, and Pirates since the 80s. And Sid's like, it's my pleasure.
Yeah.
You'll have to fritter away more of your time with really Civ Rev.
And then you have a Tim McCracken interview with CVG again. It seems that for the first time we know that the German leader is Bismarck. He says there are four ways to win the game: domination, being the first to reach Alpha Centauri, economic, and cultural victory. Economic victory seems interesting.
Yeah, we heard about economic victory last episode from Barry.
Yeah. The other interesting thing is talks about armies. And he says, you can have ninja medic marching super modern infantry that could take on the world.
Ninja medics?
That's awesome. Because I guess with armies, you can get three different units with different special abilities. And they would form an army and have all of the special abilities. So that's kind of fun.
Yeah, we also learn about, with unit upgrades in Civ Rev, that there are 9 different abilities, and each of them will have different uniforms.
Woo! And apparently, when you do something great, other civilizations recognize and give you exotic gifts. For example, the Venetians send amazing acrobats that are doing amazing acrobats in your trophy room.
With the trophy room is back?
Yes, it is.
I mean, did we know the Venetians were going to be in it?
We do now.
Yeah, we do now.
That's a weird Civ to put in there, though. Unless that's like one of those minor Civ things.
Exactly, that strikes me as kind of not a full Civ. Maybe he said Phoenicians, and the interviewer didn't really know what he was talking about. I've seen that before.
No, that's possible.
It's possible, because I've noticed some typos and a missing word here or there otherwise in the article.
I like this statement, where it says, really encourages players to search around the map for these things, because the first person who finds them gets them. I just kind of thought that was common sense, but...
Well, we are talking about people who play consoles, so... Wait, what? Actually, the quote of the article from Tim is, he says right at the beginning, I love the water. I like to say it looks so good you want to drink it.
Okay.
Well, now they're going to have a lawsuit because someone's going to try to drink it and they're going to hurt themselves. Good job.
Yay. Apparently, it seems they only have 8 wonders.
Yeah.
8 wonders of the world.
Jim mentions the pyramids. We knew about before. We saw that in the GameSpot play demo with Barry, but he also mentions the Colossus of Rhodes. And Tim lets everyone know what he believes the correct way to win the game is. My way. this is where the typo or the missing word here or there comes into play and start. He says, to win the game is to be the first civilization to colonize planners in Alpha Centauri. Do you mean planets, or therefore more than one, or do you mean just colonize Alpha Centauri? What the heck?
And then it can segue into smack revolutions.
Tremont.
Damn it.
There's going to be a dinosaurs revolutions as well, man.
All right.
Taking revolutions.
Tim says that he felt that boats were really quite useless up to Civ Rev, but now boats can bombard land units if they are near a battle. Now, I don't know if that's all boats. I wouldn't believe it would be all boats, but the fact that it's there, in addition to boats still being able to fight other boats.
Yay, my trireme can bombard. Woohoo! Jumps up on land and rams them.
And I also noticed there was some further clarification on technologies. Although, again, I think this also goes to typos or missing words here and there, but I'll get to that in a sec. It says, quote, you have a choice of between three technologies. It goes all the way from horseback riding to spaceflight. Each time you play the game, you're not going to be able to research all the technologies, so each time you're going to have to make a hard decision on what to do, unquote.
That's interesting, actually.
Yeah, so from that, then, it seems that you won't be able to research all the technologies depending upon either which three technology paths you choose, or perhaps at some point being presented with, okay, your next research is either 1, 2, 3, or can be 1, 2, 3, and depending upon which of those three you choose, that takes you down a path that's going to limit your choices in some respects, but open it up in others. So I guess we'll have to wait and see for further clarification on that.
Yeah. Interview Brad Waddell gave to GameSpy PC about Galciv 2 Twilight of Arnor, the latest universe-busting enhancement to Galactic Civilization 2. Sorry, I wanted to introduce it so people know what the hell we're talking about.
Yes, and you gave it a very nice introduction. Were those your words?
Yes. So the first question I asked is an interesting one. Is the latest expansion pack, the Galciv 2, came out in February, and why are they having one so soon? It seems doing it very quickly. And Brad says there probably won't be a sequel to Galciv 2 for a long time, and therefore they're just going to add on a few expansion packs just to add the things they wanted to, because they won't do another sequel for a while. It's kind of fun that he's like, well, we have all these good things we want to do, and we want to be able to get to it, but we're not going to do another one for a while, so why don't we just give the players the ability to do all this stuff?
It says here that now each Civ has its own technology tree.
Yeah, that's going to be a big change.
Yeah.
Mm, and they have terror stars.
Death Star.
No guesses as where they stole that from.
I wonder how long they had to sit there and come up with an alternate name. It's no moon, it's a space station.
I like when they ask him about Terra Stars, he goes, the Terra Star destroys entire systems. It's quite handy.
Oh, apparently there's also going to be a Galciv 2 2.0 that's going to be a separate thing, and it's going to be a free update coming out next year.
Ooh.
He says, we want to provide a thank you to all the players who have supported us over the past couple of years. Because now Stardock is looking at working on their fantasy strategy game.
Ooh, fantasy strategy. Ooh. Sweet.
Another thing with 2.0 is they're going to go back and try to make it more accessible to new players. Because having been a new player fairly recently, Evan, I'm like, this does what now?
I suppose they say how they're going to make it more accessible in this interview? Probably not.
No.
Oh.
Just in general, we're going to make it more accessible, but no details yet, because we're not sure ourselves.
We heard about this effort to have a pre-settler level on Civ, and we thought, hey, we're going to be for Access to the Crunch, and we're going to have one for Galciv 2. Ha-ha! All right, Brad!
Got news? Email news at abolton.net or send a private message to Dan Q, Locutus, Snoopy 369, Alexander I, or Illuminatus via Bolton's forums at abolton.net/forums.
Mailbag,
thank you, Imran. I'm missing that.
Is Civ 4 Fall from Heaven mod still Civ?
Well, I think the larger point here that it was a post on Soren Johnson's mm-hmm. personal blog, and he plucked up Polygon.
Did he? Wait, what?
Yes, he did.
I think the key point Soren makes is that the story point is not that he completely hates story, he just doesn't like it where it doesn't belong.
True, but then again, I like the effort. We went over that very much so in terms of previous podcast, the idea of stories in Threads. I guess we had a very spirited discussion. I think most of us disagreed with Soren.
It's not that he completely hates all story, just doesn't like it where it doesn't belong, and that's sort of the point you guys were making as well.
You're talking about adding stories to a Civ 4 game? What?
Well, in all games.
Well, yeah, I mean, I guess in all games. I mean, I really liked how the story was added in Alpha Centauri.
I never played it.
That's one of the reasons it's still probably my favorite Civ-ish game ever. I love that story aspect to it.
Civ 4 doesn't seem really like much of a game that would take a lot of stories. Dude, what it's based off of, I can't really see.
The sort of the point that comes up in the discussion that follows Soren's blog post, Dale points out that there is story in Civ, but in mods, for example, in Fall from Heaven, there's a lot of story in that. The question is Fall from Heaven still Civ?
Mm-hmm. Yes, because John Safer says it is not.
I would have to agree. Fall from Heaven seems more like a combination of D&D and Civ, which...
It's Civ.
Two games I like, so... But
it's Civ. It's not your grandfather's Civ.
It does seem not quite like Civ.
It's a different type of Civ.
Yeah, it opens up a big can of worms. I mean, is Call to Power Civ? Is Gal-Civ Civ? Is Rise of Nations Civ? What is Civ?
Now, if this is coming from John, I mean, in that...
Yep.
Can you also say the same thing about his mod? I mean, it's still Civ, but it's not... It's space.
Well, yeah, that's true. I mean, you know, isn't he paying himself in a little quarter there as well?
In John's last post on September 24th, just because Civ and Fall from Heaven use similar mechanics, the experience of playing the two is quite a bit different. Fall from Heaven is a more tactical RPG-ish feel than Civ. I believe there's a very distinct Civ experience. There's just a Fall from Heaven experience and a Gal Civ experience. They're all different and enjoyed by different people, which is why Fall from Heaven isn't Civ, which is why Final Frontier isn't Civ.
Which is why Smack isn't Civ.
Well, here's the thing I would say to John, response.
Oh, nails himself.
Yeah, I mean, what? Does that mean Smack is not Civ either? And as Civ evolves over the iterations that we have, maybe more things get added in to Civ in a Civ 5 or a Civ 6 that are more like Gal-Civ. How can you decide whether they are Civ if future versions of Civ may incorporate those type of things? Are they not Civ anymore?
Basically, just based off of Civ. They're not really Civ, but they're just based off it, using the same type of game.
No, I agree.
I go to Kale's forums a lot, and most of those people don't play normal Civ. They only play his mod. Mm-hmm. You know, like you just said, that's that type of player. They don't play Civ. They just play that mod.
It's interesting because Dale is the one going and saying Civ is about, to him, the rules and dependencies that form the engine. And therefore he says he believes Fall from Heaven is Civ.
Yeah, I mean, that's one argument you could make. I personally do feel that history is a key element in Civ. That is what sets it apart from other games. But I do think you can make a good argument that sci-fi and fantasy mods aren't really Civ. Yeah, I mean, it's a tough question. I mean, the gameplay in Fall from Heaven is not that different. So, I mean, where do you draw the line?
I would also argue that Smack is Civ as well. So, I mean, I fall in the boundary of basically mechanics. If it's sci-fi, that doesn't really count that much to me. Because Smack is very, very, very Civ-ish.
The gameplay is pretty much exactly the same as Civ 2, so yeah.
Exactly. I mean, there are a few differences. It's funny because a lot of the tech tree, it's almost like you're discovering same things as you would
Civ
2, but they have futuristic names.
The main thing that sets Alpha Centauri apart is really the story. You could argue that in Civ, you make your own story, and Alpha Centauri, it's at least sort of predetermined. Maybe that's what sets it apart, sort of a very philosophical debate.
Indeed. What is the nature of Civ?
To Civ or not to Civ?
To Civ or not to Civ? That is the question. Well, I think it's a very interesting discussion as it's gone on, where John says at one point, not, and I guess Solver and Dale both say, well,
yeah,
it is.
It only makes clear that there's not really necessarily one answer. Just what is Civ to you is perhaps a better question.
No.
Dale kind of asked those two questions in that one post. Is it a historically based nation simulator, or is it a set of rules that define the sandbox that the game plays in? I think it's historically based, but again, that's just my opinion.
Yeah, I think it's kind of a combination of both. Yeah, it's historically based, but it is also a set of rules. You can't make Civ real time and still really call it Civ. I don't consider Rise of Nations to really be Civ, even though it's very similar, aside from the fact that it's real time.
So the next question is next session will we discuss a blog that discusses this conversation?
Wow.
It's true. Yeah, we got mail.
And it wasn't spam.
That was the other surprise.
Call in today.
In North America, the number is 301-637-659, 301-637-Polly.
And for Europe, 44-020-7871-7659, 44-020-7871-Polly.
Or you can Skype us at the Polycast.
Seriously, where is the hate mail address?
The only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about.
For more information on the show, log on to the official Polycast website at polycast.apolton.net.
Podcast.
Say more quietly.
Yeah, damn. Seriously.
That is nasty.
That's what my freaking keyboard makes, damn it.
Shall we move to the modcast now?
Okay.
Welcome to the modcast, where we talk about various hot topics on all the different forums that talk about Civ.
Events leaving a bad taste. It seems from the thread in Civilization for General Help Strategy forums, there is a post by N. Barclay, who's saying that there are two things he finds extremely annoying about events. Actually, he just said really annoying. I added extremely. It's my own creative license. But first, he said a number of bad events destroy the things the players have, so they have to waste time replacing all that stuff. And the second, you have to maintain an unknown amount of gold and treasure in case an event involves options that are only available if you can afford them, which he says could be addressed by allowing players to go into debt temporarily to respond to events. In response, he says events do leave flavor, but some players leave a bad taste in his mouth.
You mentioned, second point, what a suggestion was by allowing players to temporarily go back into debt in response to these events. And with that, he also says, and that's not even considering what could happen if the AI is still up to its old tricks of not allowing players to maintain a gold reserve without demanding that players give them some of their gold. And on the first point about either buildings or improvements being destroyed and players having to rebuild them, he suggests a period where these buildings or improvements that have been affected are temporarily decommissioned. But then I assume after, for example, some X number of turns, they return to their full status. I find that these first and second points are interrelated because where a building or improvement is destroyed, the only chance you may have to have that building or improvement rebuilt without your rebuilding in a city or dispatching a worker to rebuild it is having a certain amount of gold in your treasury. But for me, I like these changes to the gameplay that events bring out. It's kind of an impetus for you to have your treasury in the green, not even in the black, or let alone in the red, even earlier on in the game. Because before this consideration, it was always, well, do I have enough gold to rush things, if I could even do that, or even upgrading units as quickly as possible. And we've talked in the past about how you don't necessarily want to upgrade as soon as you can. Anyway, this thing about AI still up to its old tricks, blah, 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 since we know that the AI could still be up to, as N. Barclay says, these old tricks, it's also a good incentive to keep your military defenses and offenses up to date in technology, number, and distribution. And as we know, if you don't have enough gold, the AI may still demand from you, say, a technology, or just bypass this blackmail entirely and declare war.
As far as the gold argument goes, it all comes down to interesting choices again. If you can always at any point go in the red, what's the interesting choice about events? You just wait until something comes along and you up your tax rate a bit. And now you really have to make a choice. Am I going to maximize my science, or am I going to set some gold apart so that I have more choice when interesting events come along? Adds a new dimension to the game.
Exactly. Oh no, we have to adapt our gameplay. How horrible.
Yeah.
Well, you can always turn events off.
That's no fun.
If you're a party pooper.
Yeah. I must just play differently, because I usually always have gold.
You're doing something wrong.
He covets the shiny.
I always had some gold as well. But then again, I'm a builder player, so...
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, I am too.
Still, I will give N. Barclay this out of Huntsville, Alabama. Maybe an automated option of rebuilding where necessary or otherwise chosen. So, for example, if a building is destroyed, you get an event saying, look, your building has been destroyed. At that moment, you could have an option, or it's just done automatically, that city will start rebuilding that building that was destroyed as part of its next production, or where it's an improvement, like a tile improvement, a mine, a farm, or whatever, automatically dispatch the nearest worker to rebuild it once they have completed their current order, if any. But this thing about going into debt, or this thing about temporary decommission thing, nah.
Yeah, I don't like the debt thing, because that'll take too much away from the game. Because if you add debt there, then you're going to end up, people are going to be using the debt for, like, to make the military bigger, expand their empire for domination.
Though, the one thing brought up in that thread I do agree with is that when they give you an event, they should tell you what the reward will be to see if it's actually worth it to drop everything and make, like, you know, 9 Colosseums.
No, you're talking about quests.
Or quests, whatever.
Or if they just give you a chance to go into the trade screen and try and get money from someone else to pay for it.
It seems that N. Barclay's solution, as he said in a follow-up post, I maintain a gold reserve most of the time, but drop it back to near zero at the end of researching a tech if there are advantages to getting the tech a little sooner. That way I have a good chance of getting a gold reserve available if I need it to react to an event, but I don't have to slow down my research to do it. I'd be interested to know where he puts his espionage slider in that consideration, but to each his own.
It's not worth mentioning.
Well, you don't even know where it is, so.
That's because it's an espionage slider.
Oh, wow.
AI cultural victories are evil.
You know, AI cultural victories are evil! All caps, see?
By Cybershy, a member of our own wonderful staff, saying that, yeah, he's doing all right in his game, everything's all right, and then Hatshepsut, cultural victory! She's still behind me, it's not even funny anymore. He already had 5 transports in her direction to raise one of her legendary cities, but the UN decides to force peace. Damn that UN. And I like the next post by Solver, though. In bracket, Blake. Wahahaha. Close bracket, Blake.
Yes.
If you read Cybershy's post, though, you can tell that he could see it coming. He was heading towards her, so he knew it was coming. To understand his surprise at this.
He's just frustrated because he's such a crappy player.
Oh!
Cybershy sent hate mail to him.
Yeah. The part that I really focused on in his point was that I just don't want to turn the option of culture victories off since it wouldn't feel like a real win. Not feel like a real win is certainly his personal opinion, which I disagree with. It's a slippery slope. Because if you say, well, I turn AI cultural victories off, so if I do that, then I don't really win the game. But you could easily extend that argument beyond victory conditions and then move into something more gameplay specific, like, oh, I'm going to check off vassal states, or I'm going to check off events. So if those are turned off too and you win a game with or without one or more of them, is that not a real win too?
Blake actually responds to some of the point here, and it says, remember the AI is behind because it's going for a cultural victory. So when you think an AI civ is really dogging it behind, they might be trying just to boost up 3 cities to cultural victory status.
And based on Cybershy's own description, as you mentioned before, him, he said that he had 5 transports with units headed her way to raise one of the legendary cities. So he had an inclination that that was going to happen, and it was just
he knew, yeah,
a little bit too late.
He said, I didn't expect them to get it so soon, and then couldn't declare war for 10 turns. It's like, well, defy the UN resolution then if you want to. If you really are going to...
Yeah, someone actually even stated that in one of the posts. Defy the resolution.
Yeah, so as long as you have Beyond the Sword, you can do that.
Wait, hold on. Would you just cover your ears? Because I'm about to say, damn wussy Europeans, they can't defy the UN. Okay, you can uncover your ears now.
And how would he know how to do that now that his ears are cut? Or...
Did I miss anything?
It just seems to be a case of, I don't know, he brought it on himself. Yeah.
That's what I said earlier, basically.
Blake has an interesting thing in here as well, where he says that he thinks the cities that at the last 2 cultural levels should be raised immune and ungiftable, except to the original owner, such that an aggressor actually has to permanently occupy the city. I don't know, I think it should be adapted in.
Nah.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, really.
Raise it.
That would add some more interesting, oh, this is a cultural capital. Like, could you imagine someone raising Paris to the ground?
Well, it's been done.
Never mind.
Yeah. I was trying to think of a nice way to answer that, so I just keep my mouth shut.
I don't know, Imran, did you ever hear of a little town called Carthage?
Well, that wasn't legendary cultural level. He said the last two cultural levels.
At the time, it was.
I was about to say, for the time, it was legendary enough.
At the time, how many cities in Civ have reached those levels that early on?
Everything is relative.
Oh, stop it. Next one is a CFC thread. Pen Key asks people, why are airships in the game? Wouldn't it be more interesting if they had biplanes with the same effects as airships have now, plus interception capabilities? Apparently, he says that in reality, they were not uncounterable super short-range airstrikers that could do substantial damage to units.
So. Yeah, this seems to be quite a popular discussion on CFC right now. 8-plus pages already. And if you're listening to this and you're thinking, airships, what? You either don't have Beyond the Sword, or you haven't managed to get far enough of Beyond the Sword to see them. Keep trying.
That would be me.
I always die before then.
Me too.
No, it's I always win before then. Yes, that's...
What's that, Dan? I always go into the World Builder before then?
I wouldn't even use the World Builder to put in airships. There you go. To be fair, someone said they find them useful for reconnaissance, but not so much for combat. And I would find them useful for reconnaissance where the situation makes it possible. Like, you could actually get near enough to an AI's territory that I could actually use that. But I think that's a pretty limited situation. They're definitely horrible in combat, and I would rather use my city's resources and gain turns, period, on building other units or building otherwise.
I like Rusty Edge's comment on page 8. Airships, I think. I have a dental appointment. See you later. He just leaves.
It's kind of interesting, the disparity in responses, though, on this turn. Some people are like, I hate them. They're horrible. We should get rid of them. And other people are like, yeah, they're no big deal. They're well-balanced. They're not that game-breaking or so. You seem to have, like, two different factions. It doesn't seem to be that much of a consensus, at least early on.
They're kind of like the ironclad of the air, but perhaps it's a little bit of an edge over an ironclad comparatively, but why even bother? I suppose you could use them if you know you're going to lose the game and you need something to laugh at, so you build them.
I consider this discussion to be a bit dull. But does anyone here really care that airships are in the game, one way or the other?
No. Makes no difference to me. I've never played with them yet. What's bad is I'm the moderator of that forum, and I haven't even read this.
Welcome to the Research Lab, where we explore game concepts or ideas that are not in Civilization yet, but they might be in the future.
Nine suggestions for the Civilization series editions by Fox URA. He's got solution to deserts. Basically, one is canal improvement, moving fresh water and ships, flat tile function as an artificial river.
Already have canals. Forts can do that now.
Yeah, but I think he wants to buff them a little bit.
I think they're quite powerful enough as they are.
Well, it's just build speed bonuses is what it looks like, mostly. And the ability for pillaging.
Yeah, because this thread started off as the solution to deserts. The desert reclamation, it looks like this person would like terraforming back.
Yeah, for deserts.
For deserts, anyway.
Nobody else posted it.
Yeah, I know. He wants some beach resorts as well, or desert tiles bordering on large bodies of water. The ones holding oasis. And
in desert?
A fish farm in the desert.
They branch off from desert after that. They go into fish farm, then woodworking, river width, making like a small, medium, and large rivers, inland ports.
Now, the stuff below, is that still part of the desert? Because why would you want a primitive bridge in a desert?
No, I think it shifts away from desert afterwards. Because he says on the top, a lot of suggestions, little to do with deserts. Little to nothing to do with deserts. So I guess the fish farm, the woodworking, river width, inland port, primitive bridge, causeways are not desert related. And some of them are actually interesting. I think a causeway would be to span maybe one tile of water or something like that. Have like a bridge for that. And river width is somewhat interesting. I'm not sure how they would work that in, but
I don't know, we talked before about bridges and how in game one tile really represents a very
large amount of space, realistically. But, oh, I see. He's got different levels of causeways. Oh.
And also, it's not like Navy isn't already pretty useless. So I don't know that we should take even more away from it.
But I like the idea of having a simple causeway type of thing.
I like because I have gotten tired of typing.
The inland port seems somewhat interesting, but I don't know if it should be able to participate in ocean... Well, I guess it says built on a large river. If you're doing the river with stuff, I guess that might make sense, but...
Yeah, I have argued in the past that you should make navies a lot more important if you make at least some rivers navigable.
Yeah.
And yeah, in that case, inland ports make perfect sense, of course. And it's just that the river just becomes an extension of what's now ocean. And yeah, of course, you could build harbors and everything in that as well.
Yeah, but even in real life, how many rivers are big enough? Can you take like a destroyer or something that up? It just inland port doesn't really seem very logical.
Maybe you'd have to limit the type of ships that can use it.
Yeah, I think inland port should be half of regular ocean-bound trading because the size of ships...
That's really only an issue in maybe the last 100 years or so. The biggest port in the world is Rotterdam.
That's true.
Not a seaport. London, another example. That's inland. It's also always been a big port city. So, yeah, that's really a modern phenomenon. The ships become so big that you really need to have ports close to the ocean. I can see that happen, and I have argued for it in the past because it would make Navy more important. But yeah, you can argue forever about how you want to balance that in the exact implementation, because it's going to be problematic. And right now, rivers are between tiles. I mean, where do the units go?
I know, that is the big thing there. It's how are you going to balance it out?
Major implementation issues for that, but it is something that I would like to see in some form or another. It would be nice.
Welcome to the Senate. In this section, we talk about game strategy.
I'm sorry, you'll give some of it what you cut out.
Yeah.
Oh, some of it. All right, never mind. Senate, where do you like to start and why? Started by 6K Man. Says, basically, he has a little poll here. Where do you like to start out? Choices include being on an island with room for a dozen cities with one AI, to being on the coast with many water tiles per city, and et cetera, et cetera. The one that's winning out right now with 48% of the vote is being on one end of a continent slash Pangaea with several AIs in one direction.
Well, that's no fun. Makes it too easy.
Well, it also makes it less stressful because you're not having to watch your border on all sides.
That's true. Maybe that's why he's saying it's too easy.
Yeah, it takes away the fun of it when pretty much leave one side empty and move all your forces to the other side to prepare to attack or defend. It's more fun. They're all around you.
Yes, being on a continent Pangaea with right in the middle of several AIs has 10 votes, which is 17.24%. That's third best. The second best is being on a coast with many water tiles per city. So I guess the one end slash coast, which actually could be similar, seems to be the most popular type of setup there.
Although we have to be careful with how this poll has been set up, because you can choose more than one option when you vote.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
I would like to see a poll like this where people have to choose one.
But people, they'd complain. They'd be like, I like both of these. Yeah.
That explains why my favorite option is missing, and that's all of the above, because I like to change it around.
I guess that would have to fall under the otherwise category.
Please describe. No one has clicked that though yet.
Yeah, that was empty.
Yeah, that's interesting. And if it was a poll on Polly, that last one would say other.
Banana-shaped
or otherwise. Which starts would each of us prefer? I guess Nicholas has come out saying that he likes being on a continent right in the middle of several AIs.
I like to also have it vary, though. I mean, bounce around, not always be in the same type of game. It's more fun if sometimes you're in the middle, sometimes you're on the side, sometimes by yourself. It makes more variance of the game, makes it more fun, and once makes me want to keep playing it.
Exactly. I try as many different map types as possible, different number of opponents on the same size map. Just change things around. It's lots more fun.
For me, I'd prefer whatever option will give me the opportunity to be in contact with one or more AIs early on in the game so I can trade technologies, although preferably not trade any military technologies I have for military technologies that other civs have, but usually that doesn't go over well. But where it does...
After he said that, watch next game, Dan is put right next to Tokugawa.
Want to trade?
No. I also like, as soon as possible, to be able to not just trade technology for technology, but also in part or just entirely for gold to help finance either my trade deficit, combination of expansion, that espionage research balancing if you're playing with Beyond the Sword, and unit upgrading from time to time.
I like usually being close to water. Variance is always good, whether that's on the end of a continent or on an island or whatnot. I like the sea.
Why is that? Because you like the trade benefits?
Yeah, I like the trade benefits. I like having a little navy. It's all good. I like going for the more money-making types of civics, and the trade benefits allow me to make more money. Money is good.
I guess it also brings up is what is the main type of map people would want to play. So a lot of the war people are going to be playing Pangea, stuff like that.
True. Easier for them to take over people. But then again, I'd imagine there'd be some sort of interesting challenge in a more islandish type of setup or continent. Or you have to have huge amphibious warfare type of things.
Especially in Beyond the Sword.
Especially. I'm not sure why, but okay.
That would be improval in naval combat on the part of the AI, actually, Imran.
Oh, okay.
If you lose all your games, you don't really notice the difference anyway.
Woohoo!
Don't stop the battle.
I just got chariots. Where did those tanks come from?
Oh, Imran, it wouldn't even be that. You wouldn't even know it was called a tank.
Oh, that's true.
Mm-hmm.
What's that tank-looking thing? Shall we move on to Loving Privateers, by the way?
The topic, not actually. Yeah.
Yeah. Let's talk about Loving Privateers. Wargamer, who is known as Gandhi of the Mongols on the CFC, has basically created a thread saying, I love privateer, and apparently we're just loves the unit. I like them too, actually. They're very fun to use, and even if you don't want to attack random age of sail people, you can avoid borders so you can explore a little bit more.
Away from frigates, though, right?
Yes.
Yeah, because Wargamer says he loves to use them strategically so that they can get promoted, and then he can upgrade them later on to great destroyers when the time comes, and then he just disbands the others. Gameplay-wise, I like the balance and the choice the player has to make on privateers, but my choice remains not to generally use them because of the frigate threat. Now, there may be circumstances where I could access the coasts of AIs and hopefully do some damage, and they not have frigates or have frigates of other AIs in that territory, too. Oh, look, there's a civilization. It's in the Age of Sail. Oh, wait, they have an open borders agreement with them, and they have frigates. Oh, crap.
Damn those frigates.
I know it's going to probably sound crazy, but if I really feel the need for early coastal defense, I find myself building and maintaining galleys just because they seem to be a lot less of a target than privateers for obvious reasons. Unless, of course, I'm at war, in which case... If they're there for show, if I'm actually in war, I'll probably just take them back into the cities. Run away, run away! Don't go to war with us! We'll kick your butt! Oh no, we're at war! Goodbye! No one loves privateers. No one's feeling the love.
I said I did.
I only built my first privateers last night.
Oh.
So I don't know. Ooh. I'll let you know.
Ooh, girls talking about playing Civ.
I like it when they talk about loving privates. I mean privateers.
Politon University.
Oh, yeah, that's right. We do have that.
If people do want to learn how to play Civ better, there is a good way for competitive playing to have other people give you advice. That's the Politon University.
And we would find that where? Jeez.
Politon.net.
Really?
Forums?
Wow. How could I figure that out?
I don't know.
Politon University. Sometimes I wonder.
You have entered the vault where segments cut from earlier episodes find relevance later.
So how's the game with dual core? Has anyone here tried it?
I wouldn't know.
Neither would I.
So, who among us has a dual core?
Well, according to the people on the thread, it might not necessarily help all that much.
No.
Though I did notice I had little bits of the speed up, because I have the same amount of memory on this machine that I had on my old machine. This new one has dual core, but it ran
some of the videos and things that would stutter used to now will run smoothly. It could also be the hard drive, I don't know.
Yeah, I guess it could be many things, but it will probably help a little bit, because as was also pointed out in the thread, for Civ 4 doesn't make any kind of difference. The game is not aware of other cores, just uses the one processor, but if you have stuff running in the background, and on Windows you typically have 30 or 40 processors running in the background, those processors can all run on different core, and that can make a bit of difference. So it really depends on how optimized your system is. If a really clean, lean, empty system with nothing unnecessary running, it probably won't make too much of a difference. But if you have, Skype and AIM and firewall, antivirus, it all adds up.
Yeah.
And it can make quite a big of a difference.
Yeah, and you're still seeing Polly in the background. And
yeah. I think RAM is really, together with the video card, that's the most important hardware requirement for Civ.
Yeah.
You really want to have, for big maps, 2 gig of RAM.
And for big mods, that have, like, outrageous amounts of content.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that also helps.
That also increases your RAM requirements out the wazoo.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's going crazy.
So people are looking at new machines. You don't have to go dual core just for Civ 4. Just buy more RAM.
Yes, more RAM.
Take how much RAM you think you'll need and triple it.
If your motherboard even supports that much.
I've only got one myself, but it works well enough. Some of the graphics settings I have to lower because of my graphics card.
Remember, depending on your operating system, it may not support more than about 3.3.
Yeah, on XP, 32 bits, that's not going to work now. But
different versions of Vista support different amounts of RAM. I've got Home Premium, which does up to 16, but of course my motherboard doesn't go that high, so.
Yeah, that's true. We are running into a bit of a limit till we truly switch to 64 bits.
Yeah, it's a transition. It'll take a couple more years before the industry is completely 64-bit, and then it'll take a few more years after that for all the users to catch up as well.
That's true.
But then we'll be good.
Which means by the time Civ 5 comes out, we probably will be able to use a dual-core or a quad-core CPU.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sure we will.
The code has to be written in order to take advantage of the cores.
Exactly.
Galactic Civilization 2 Dark Avatar, favorable reviews. Yes, it's not just on a bulletin.
Yeah, it's actually GameSpy's February 2007 winner for Game of the Month.
GameRankings.com and Metacritic.com. Actually, the Dark Avatar expansion. Average higher percentage than its parent title. Now, true, there are more Dreadlords reviews than Dark Avatar reviews, but still, that's interesting. The reviewer for GameZone, Anise Hollingshed, actually said she likes the micromanagement in these type of games. She gave it 85%, 95% on a top pick from Ricky Starscream Tucker over at Game Vortex, who notes that if this is action that you're looking for, it's probably not your thing, as this is for the hardcore strategy nut.
In other words, pretty much most everyone on Polly?
We mentioned GameSpy. He actually gave Dark Avatar a perfect 5 out of 5, though perhaps that's a little too high since he does cite some negatives. I mean, how can you be perfect if you criticize? Come on, Alan. Over at GamesRadar, Troy Goodfellow says, this worthy expansion gives you a reason to conquer the galaxy again.
Shouldn't you reason to conquer the galaxy?
Strategy Gamer's motto, why'd you conquer it? Because it was there.
All of your planets are belong to us.
Uh-huh, exactly.
Troy says that the AI is stronger on most areas except trade. That's kind of what Solver said in his Dark Avatar review that we featured in episode 10. Wow. Actually, my favorite score is 7 out of 8 on Out of 8's website, because it's out of 8 as opposed to 10. Says, I do find it interesting, depending upon what reviewer's account you read, the same facts are sometimes categorized as good or bad. The lack of multiplayer and the price for the expansion. Some people don't even talk about one or the other, and some person will say that the lacking multiplayer is bad in this day and age, but some people say it's good because the artificial intelligence is so strong. And others say that the price for the expansion is a tad pricey, while another person says that the game offers plenty of additions and modifications and tweaks as well worth it.
When there's both multiplayer and AI players, the game has to be balanced both. If there's no multiplayer, then it can be balanced entirely for the single player. Like in Civilization, the multiplayer game is quite different from the single player. For example, strategies like mass catapults and that, which are effective in multiplayer, but in single player wouldn't really come up. So I think that sometimes no multiplayer is a blessing because it means a single player can be focused on.
Take it or leave it, folks. Dark Avatar, but if you do take it, please remember to buy it through Bolt. Had to get that in there.
Will 9, he talked about combustion. You should be able to make the highway system as a national wonder. It would give tourism to coastal cities and cities with wonders. Also, the Autobahn should be a global wonder that has a higher effect than the highway system. Perhaps to be able to build the global wonder Autobahn, you would first have to create the highway system first. And even then, the highway system national wonder could only be built in cities that have reached a certain population level. If your city is a level 1, why would...
Why have a highway?
Exactly. And then whatever the effects, the full extent of either the highway system or the Autobahn could only be realized by those cities that have reached or exceeded that population level and are somehow connected to the city that built the wonder and are on the same continent. I know I'm kind of putting a lot of qualifications in here, but...
Let me translate for Dan. If you're talking about what about my other continent... Dan says, screw you. We're not thinking about that.
Ooh.
There you go, Dan. Back to you.
Thanks a lot. I guess there's also a suggestion that one of the endgame techs, you should be able to upgrade railroads into maglev rails.
Maglev? Now we're getting a little too complicated.
But then now you might say, but Dan, what if we have cities on multiple continents? That means we're going to have to choose which continent we want to have this on. I realize that, you know, in real life, you could have a different highway system on those continents. But again, what you incorporate into Civ must be balanced gameplay-wise first. Mm. We need coal in order to build railroads, but is that really necessary as time goes on? Perhaps you could introduce a technology whereby you wouldn't need coal anymore.
Mm.
Doesn't that just get your mind turning?
Well, perhaps. It only turns a little bit. I'm sorry. And, of course, we don't have railroad used as much as they used to be, so perhaps the benefits should go away over time, too. But then again, now we're getting a little too complicated. Just because we thought of it doesn't make it good. I know, Dan, I know.
Don't you love the threads on here where people are trying to say, why can't I get women? Because you're here.
Hello.
But you know, if we were to take Apollo's moderators and CFC's moderators and merge them as part of Civ Junction, we would have a complete hole or something.
Mm-hmm. Civ Junction, Junction, what's your function?
Oh my god, I thought of it.
I'm really enjoying the BTS tri-tournaments. There's some other word in there, too.
Tri-League.
That's it, Tri-League.
Oh, yeah, Mackie's part of that, too.
That would be the game I built my privateers in earlier.
Ah.
Look at that.
Hey, I haven't finished the game. No spoilers.
What? Me building a privateer is not a spoiler. That just tells you where I am.
Girls playing soon.
I'm red.
You know I don't mean it.
Dan does.
So, the question also goes to Mackie. Are you always hit on these things or flirted with in every single episode?
Or was that? No, actually.
Really?
It's just in the forums. Just comments in the forums like, ooh, dreamy type of things.
And when Dan is trying to impress co-hosts.
Have a girl.
So being on Polycast isn't quite like listening to it, though.
No.
It's far, far worse.
I get a more of a understanding, too.
Did you ever agree to do this again?
Yeah, I enjoyed it.
Wow.
It was a lot of fun. I'd do it again. How come it says I get a chance at the Polycast episode 28 topics? I have the ability to delete it.
Huh?
Oh.
Top left corner, I can actually hit delete. Oh, wait.
You mean you can delete the PM that I sent you with the topics?
Oh, that's a PM, isn't it? Dork. I proved my wife's point. Dork.
You just listened to episode 28 of Polycast, the official podcast of Fulton Civilization Site. I am Imran Siddiqui. Imran Siddiqui on the forums. Say hi.
Hi.
Joined by Dan, getting quick, Dan Q on the forums.
That's me.
Makalua.
That's me.
And also joined by Wouter Snyders, known as the cutest on the forums.
Hi.
And our guest, co-host, Mythos from CFC.
Hello.
Actually, it's a goodbye. But
I was wondering why we were doing this at the end.
It's amazing we ever have any return guest co-hosts.
record date September 29th, 2007. Soundtrack courtesy Civilization IV Warlords and Beyond the Sword. Copyright 2007, Appleton Civilization site at appleton.net.